So now please, as we begin this evening, the first thing we do with any Dharma teachings, we first need to check our motivations. It's, of course, you know, I think just coming here, as Trungpa Rinpoche always says, but just coming here is, of course, a sign that you have a good motivation to begin with. That you came here with a good motivation, but by the time you actually arrive here and sit down, you might get distracted, or you might remember something, you might get upset about something, or whatever. And things can change in your mind. So it's always good at the moment that we actually begin the teaching to check your motivation and make sure that you please have a good motivation. There's not much purpose to studying the Dharma other than to do it to bring benefit to yourself and to other sentient beings. And then the question is the degree of benefit, and we'll speak about that quite a bit this evening. But at the best, because the text we're going to be talking about for the next for this weekend, the way of the Bodhisattva, the best is if you can have the pure motivation of bodhicitta, the wish to bring all sentient beings to the state of Buddhahood, no matter how long it takes, no matter how hard it is to bring all sentient beings to that state of complete and lasting happiness. But that's a difficult motivation to immediately walk off the street or to immediately come in and start. So we have. And so if not that, at least the motivation to bring benefit to yourself, to bring yourself to liberation, a liberation from the sufferings of samsara, and to bring benefit to yourself in this, not just in this life, but a longer term. One of the difficulties of approaching a text like this is that it's coming from a very different context, a very different cultural context. So sometimes I think when we talk about this, we hear about Western Buddhism, people say, well, therefore we should make Buddhism more Western. But another approach to it is to think that we actually need to learn what is it. We have our own prejudices that come from our own background, our own, not necessarily prejudices, but our own expectations that come from an educational system. Sometimes when we approach a text like this one, it's difficult to approach because there's talk about things that, like reincarnation and so forth, that are difficult to accept the first time you come in and hear about them. So the question about how do we approach that? So when we think about a text like this, when we think about studying a text like this, it's important that we try to remember not just that there are differences because of the culture of that being ancient India. There are differences of the culture being now contemporary America. And so we have to have both in mind when we approach a text like this, that we can really try to get what the actual meaning of the text is. So when we have the initial motivation of this, we should try to have as vast motivation as we can, whether it be bodhicitta itself, or whether it be the wish for liberation, or a wish, just a general wish to bring benefit to ourselves and others, which is a very good place to start. But in any case, please try to listen this evening with a good motivation. And the text that we are speaking about is The Way of the Bodhisattva by Shantideva. So Shantideva was a master from the 7th century in India. And we know that he is a 7th century master because when the Chinese translators came through Nalanda University, where Shantideva taught this text, they came through in the early part of the 7th century. And there's no mention of Shantideva at that time in the works of Xunzang. Xunzang talked about everyone studying the works by Vasubandhu, Asanga, Nagarjuna, Dharmakirti, later masters, but there's no mention of any Shantideva. But by the time the Dharma was brought to Tibet at the beginning of the 8th century, there is mention of Shantideva, and Shantideva's works was actually one of the earliest works brought over in one form. So we know that sometime after Xunzang left Nalanda, and I don't remember the exact year, I'm sorry, I should have looked that up, but I didn't. We know that it was sometime in the 7th century. Now, there are various different stories about Shantideva's life. And if you look at it's a work also, because it's such an influential work, both in India after it was written and in Tibetan Buddhism in particular. Because it's such an important work, there are many translations of it into English already. There are at least 4 published translations, portions of a 5th that are available online, and then there's my one that we're going to be going through tonight. So it's a frequently translated work. And if you look at some of them, particularly the translation by Kate Crosby and Andrew Skilton, it talks about the history of the work of the text. Where was I going on this? Oh, they talk about the life of Shantideva, and as many of these, especially, and if you look at academic work also, there's a lot of skepticism among Western academics that Shantideva really could have lived a life such as traditionally is told, because it does talk about things that are generally not accepted, like miracles. But anyways, this is the traditional story of Shantideva's life, one of the traditional versions. There is a long commentary on Shantideva's Way of the Bodhisattva written by a great 16th century Tibetan master named Pao Tsulak Trenwa. And that's the basis for Trungpa Rinpoche's commentary on it in Tibetan, which is actually more taking all the extra material out and just giving the commentary on the words. And in Pao Tsula Trungpa's commentary, he gives, I think, 4 different versions of, or parts of 4 different versions of Shantideva's life. But I'm going to explain it according to the most popular of these versions. So Shantideva was born, he was a prince, and his name when he was originally born, his father's name was Chantivarman, and his own name was Shantivarman when he was born. And as a young prince, he came into contact with Buddhist teachers, and he got the meditation practice of Manjushri. So Manjushri is the bodhisattva of prajna, which means like discriminating wisdom, it's often translated as. And so he did this meditation practice when he was very young, and he was able to actually have visions of the bodhisattva Manjushri himself. Now, one day, Shantivarman's father passed away. And so because his father passed away and he was the prince, he was going to be made prince the next day. He was going to be coronated the next day. When he had a dream at that night, and in his dream, Manjushri came and was sitting on his father's throne, and Manjushri said to him, my son, my only son, this is my seat. I am your spiritual master. in no way would it be appropriate for you and me to both sit on one seat. And so in the morning when Shantideva, Shantavarman woke up, he realized that there was no way he could accept the kingship, so he fled. And so this is what is called the first of the seven wondrous tales, that he fled the, left the prince's life behind, left the palace life behind. And he went and he became a monk at the great Nalanda University. So Nalanda University was in the 7th century, it was at its height, it was one of the great Buddhist universities of ancient India. It was founded in, I think, the 3rd century, and it flourished for a millennium. It had 10,000 students. It's a huge complex that they've excavated some parts of it, the area around the library and many of the monasteries, if you ever go to on a pilgrimage to it. But at its height, it had 10,000 students of all different nationalities, or all of the different Buddhist nationalities, that means different areas of India and surrounding countries, all the different lineages of Buddhism. It also had non-Buddhist students. It was the great center for learning, but it was primarily focused on the study of Buddhism. So Shantideva went there, he took the vows as a monk, and he was given the name Shantideva. Now, Shantideva had already done all his meditation practice. He had accomplished the practice of Manjushri, and he basically had understood Buddhism in its entirety already. But he went there to this great monastery where everyone is engaged in study and very diligent about their study. But he didn't need to be diligent about his study, so he didn't do anything. He just sort of sat around. Didn't do anything. Now, this is a place where you're supposed to, engage in debate and scholarship and so forth and be part of it. And there's this one monk who wasn't, Shantideva wasn't doing it. So all of his other people said he only thinks about three things: eating, sleeping, and pooping. So they called him Busuku, which basically means eat, sleep, poop. And it's a real disgrace for him, Nalanda, to have such a completely lazy monk sitting there, just doing nothing. They're trying to figure out, how can we get rid of this? I mean, actually, Nalanda is a really exclusive place to get in. You had to pass these very difficult entrance exams to get in. You had to be diligent to be there. It was like worse than Harvard, harder to get in than Harvard or anything like that. So they wanted to figure out, we've got this useless monk here, we need to figure out a way to get rid of him. Well, they thought of it. And this is actually a way of getting rid of lazy monks that had been tried before. They tried with other lazy monks in the past. What they did is, every year on the Festival of Miracles, that's the anniversary of the Buddha performing miracles in Shravasti, they would set up a big lion throne in the middle of the Nalanda campus, and someone would sit on it and recite sutras or teach Dharma or something like that in commemoration of the miracles. So they thought, okay, this is what we'll do. We'll make it Busuku's turn to teach the Dharma. And because he's so lazy, because he doesn't do anything, he'll refuse and he'll run away, and then we'll be free of this lazy monk. So they got the abbots of Nalanda to agree to this scheme. They told Shantideva, it's your turn. You have to teach the Dharma now. And they expected him to say no and run away, but he didn't. And he said, he hesitated a little bit. He didn't immediately agree, but eventually he did agree. And then everyone heard that Busuku was going to be teaching the Dharma, so this huge crowd of people gathered to listen to him teach the Dharma, because obviously he was a fool who didn't do anything, so what would he do? Everyone was curious to see, what would this person do? And he walked up there to the throne, and suddenly he was sitting on top of the throne, and no one actually saw him get on top of the throne. They couldn't figure out. He was over there, and then he was on top of the throne. How did he get on top of the throne? So people were starting to get a little bit suspicious when they saw this happen. It was a little strange. Then they said, then Shantideva asked them, "Now, would you like to hear some Dharma that has already been taught, or would you like to hear something new?" And so they said, this was even weirder, so they said, "We want to hear something new." Here's Buzugu. He wants to recite something new. And then he recited from memory the way of the Bodhisattva. He had written three treatises, the Compendium of the Sutras, the Sutra Samuchaya, the Compendium of the Trainings, the Shiksha Samuchaya, and this one, the Bodhisattva Charyavatara, the Way of the Bodhisattva. And he recited it from beginning to end, and people were just amazed at it all the way through. When he got to the ninth chapter, the chapter on Prajna, he started to levitate into the sky, and he levitated so high that he was invisible, but his voice was still heard, and so he then completed the ninth chapter and recited the tenth chapter on dedications, and he had disappeared. So immediately everyone at Nalanda recognized that this was just a really important work. And there are many scholars in the audience who had achieved the dharani of never forgetting. They memorized it. They heard it once and they memorized it. Actually, there were two different versions that they memorized. Some of the scholars memorized, heard it as being in 9 chapters and 700 verses long. Some of them heard it as being in 10 chapters and 1,000 verses long. So they knew they had to settle which of these verses, which of these versions was it. So they sent out an expedition to find him, and they found him in the south of India. And they asked him which version was it, and Shantideva said it was the 10-chapter version and 1,000 verses. And by the way, if you also look in the rafters of my cell in Nalanda, you will find my two other books. And so they went and they found his two other books written in very tiny handwriting, apparently, according to the Pavatsalar Trinoy commentary. So this is the second amazing tale. The third amazing tale is that he then went to the east of India, and the details on this tale are not very clear in either Pavatsula Trangwa's commentary or in another or in the other commentary I looked at, the one by Kenpo Kuzan Palden, which has been translated into English. Basically he went to the east, he prevented a war, brought peace, and convinced everyone to become Buddhist. So that's the third amazing tale. The fourth amazing tale is that he was in the eastern part of Magadha, which is a region of central India. Nalanda University, for example, is in the area of Magadha. And there was a great famine, and during this famine, he collected an alms bowl full of rice gruel, and by the power of his meditation, he was able to feed a large number of people out of this and also convert them to Buddhism. The fifth tale is actually very similar to that. The fifth tale is that there were 1,000 beggars who were starving, and so he was able to feed them through his miraculous power. So the third, the fourth, and the fifth tales. The sixth tale is that he then went traveling around, and he stopped being a monk. He was kind of a yogi. And he went and he became a member of the king's bodyguard, and he had a wooden sword made out of sandalwood, but a very special sword. And whenever he would go into battle, their army would always win before the battle began, and they knew it was because of this special sword. So the king said, "You have to show me your sword." And Shantideva said, "I'm sorry, I can't show you my sword. You really don't want me to show you your sword." And the king said, you have to. And all the ministers and everyone said, you must show him your sword. It's just a wooden... And Shantideva said, I can't show you your sword. They said, how can you defeat people with a wooden sword? Armies. How can you defeat armies with a wooden sword? And Shantideva said, okay, king, I will show you. But you have to cover one of your eyes. And so the king covered one eye. And then Shantideva pulled the sword just about an inch outside of the scabbard. And the light was so blinding that the king's eye, the uncovered eye, popped out and fell on the floor. And then he put the sword back in, and through his the power of his meditation, he was able to restore the king's sight. So that is the sixth wondrous tale. And the seventh wondrous tale he was traveling in the south of India. He's kind of a naked ascetic. He was just traveling around and not doing much of anything, but they knew he was Buddhist. They came to a kingdom where there was a non-Buddhist extremist. In Tibetan, we call them extremists, mutikpa, extremists, extremist teacher. What extremist means, it's not like, you know, a fanatic in the normal contemporary sense. It means someone who holds the extreme of either being nihilist or of being eternalist. So this is Shankar, an extremist named Shankar, which is a very famous name, so I don't think it's necessarily the same Shankar who's famous for the Kashmiri Advaita school. So Shankar said, I'm going to draw a mandala in the sky through my miraculous power, and if you Buddhists can't destroy this mandala by the power of your meditation, then everyone in the kingdom has to convert to Hinduism. So everyone was very upset because none of the monks there had any miraculous power. They didn't know what to do. King was frantic. He didn't want to have to convert to Hinduism. They thought, well, you know, this beggar, he's supposed to be a Buddhist, so maybe he can do something. He's a Buddhist yogi of some sort. And so they said, will you help us? And he said, I can help you. But what I need is two pieces of fabric, a jug of water, fire, a little bit of fire, and some wood. The next morning, Shankara goes and he starts, goes into meditation and he starts drawing a mandala in the sky. He got the eastern gate. So mandala, actually, we use the word mandala and we always think about it as being like circular things, but actually a mandala is like a palace. They've got gates on the different, in the four cardinal directions. And so he drew the eastern gate in the sky. And then Shantideva at that point started meditating, and as he meditated, this incredible wind kicked up, and it blew the mandala away, it blew Shankar away, it blew everyone away, it blew all the houses down. It was probably worse than Hurricane Irma. And the king and queen were, you know, all their clothes were blown away, so he took the two pieces of fabric and he gave them to the king for clothes. He took the jug of water and gave them food and water, and he used the sticks to rebuild houses miraculously. So that's the seventh of the seven miraculous tales of the life of Shantideva. So, you know, this was the 7th century when things like this still happened. We don't do it anymore. We don't believe in these things anymore. And so it is a good question. How do we approach stories like this? Because there are all sorts of stories that come up throughout Buddhist literature. There are even stories at the time of the Buddha, of the Buddha performing miracles, that are attested by all the schools. And in fact, if you look in the Abhidharma literature of the Theravada school, it tells you, gives you instructions on how to perform these miracles, but then it says you can only do this if you have as much mental control as a Buddha. There are lots of tales of great beings levitating in the sky, but we don't see these things happening. So the question is, how do we relate to this idea of miracles? What does it mean when we talk about miracles? Well, one of the most important things that it comes from a teaching of the Buddhas in the Vinaya. The Buddha took one of the monks down to the hell realms to show him the hell realms, just so that this monk would actually believe. And showed himself to some hell beings who felt faith and then were immediately liberated from the hell realms. And what the text in the Vinaya says is that people, ordinary people, are easily fooled by miracles. The beings in the hell thought that it was by the power of the Buddha that they were freed, but it was because of the power of their faith when they saw the Buddha that they were freed. It was because of the change in their own mind. So it's important when we see these, when we read these stories about miracles, on the one hand, if you take it in an academic way, you could say that it's important because it gives people something to, you know, simple people who believed in miracles, something to feel faith in that then inspires them to Dharma practice. And there may be something to that. On the other hand, when you think about what miracles are, the Gyalwan Karmapa said this to me one day. A miracle is when you understand the nature of things so well that you can do things that other people don't think are possible. So, for example, if we look at, you know, a jetliner, and you showed it to someone from the 7th century, and they came and they saw a jetliner flying, this huge metal thing, first of all, how did you make it? And second of all, how does it actually fly into the sky? They'd say, this is a miracle. How can something fly like this? It's not actually a miracle. It's that we just understand a little bit of physics, and we know how to have engines that'll make it happen. So when you have an understanding of the nature of phenomena, then you are able to do things that that appear miraculous to other people. So I think that to me is the most convincing way to think about what miracles actually are. Not necessarily miracles such as, having magic swords, but the miracles of, really, what's the greatest miracle? The greatest miracle is that we wake up in the morning, frankly. We don't die overnight. I mean, it's pretty impressive that we actually manage to wake up every morning. When you think about how complicated the system that keeps us alive really is. So that's the author of this text, Shantideva. Whether or not he actually performed the miracles, whether or not we have the power to the ability to perceive the miracles that he might have performed, when we look at the text, it's clearly a text that shows an incredible understanding of the teachings of the Buddha, because almost everything that he says in the text has a source somewhere in the teachings, in one of the sutras of the Buddhas. Brings it all together. This is not, I mean, it's an original composition in that he took all these teachings and arranged them in a coherent way that shows the path of the bodhisattva from what we need to do to become a bodhisattva, what we need to do to maintain that to do the practice of a bodhisattva. It all has a source in some sutra or the other, and the commentary, such as Pao Tsula Trangwa's commentary, shows, you know, where do all of these teachings come from. When the Buddha taught, the Buddha would go around teaching in many different places, and he'd give specific teachings to specific individuals in specific places. So he didn't necessarily think about having a single coherent teaching of the Buddha. There are many different teachings given in different places to different individuals. There are teachings that were collected by some individuals that became the Theravada, the teachings of the Theravada school. And there are the teachings that were brought north into the regions of Gandhara and Kashmir that became the basis of the Mahayana school. Different teachings for different people. And then these were all brought together by great masters such as Shantideva into treatises that we can then read and understand and get without having to go through, you know, the Tibetan scriptures. The words of the Buddha are voluminous. There are 108 volumes of it. It's too much for one person to read. So masters such as Shantideva condensed these into a way that we can work with. And this is one of the great treatises of the Indian tradition. But unlike some of the other great treatises of the Indian tradition, like the Treasury of Abhidharma, or the Commentary on Validity of the Pramanavartika, or the work of Nagarjuna, or something like this, this work is really fairly easy to understand. It's very inspiring work. The masters at Nalanda immediately recognized it as such. That's why they were so eager to find Shantideva and determine which version was the real version. It's been an inspiring text itself, but it also has a lot of rigor in terms of, first of all, in terms of the sources, that everything has a source. Also in terms of the thought, particularly in the ninth chapter, the chapter on Prajna, which is the one that is kind of famous, I think, sometimes. It's a wonderful exposition of the Madhyamaka school of Tibetan Buddhism. So sometimes people think this is the most important part of the text. It is an important part of the text. But we have to get there first. So actually the other chapters are all very important as well. But their topics are actually much more easy to get into as beginners. The text was brought to Tibet around the time that Buddhism was brought there and first translated, and there was a copy of a Tibetan translation of the text that was found in the manuscripts, the 9th century manuscripts found at the Dunhuang Cave, which is now in the Xinjiang province of the People's Republic of China. That's the version that has 700 verses. So some scholars, some present-day scholars, will tell you, okay, this must be the authentic version because it's earlier. It's in 9 chapters, and they will look at the 2nd and 3rd chapters of the 10-chapter version and say, well, these two really could be 2 chapters, 1 chapter. And in many ways, they do fit as 1 chapter. They look at other chapters, and they say, some of these verses weren't written by Shantideva. They do the linguistic analysis and find this. So that's one tradition that has that 700 verse version. And then there's the 10 verse version, and this is the canonical version. And even with this version, there are slight differences. If we look at the very end of the text, there is the colophon that explains that it was first translated according to one set of texts in Kashmir, and then brought and checked against texts from Magadha, central India. And so that's the standard Tibetan version. So when you go and you look at the bewildering number of English translations, of which I'm in the process of making even more bewildering, there are 2 translations that are from the Sanskrit. The translations by Kate Crosby and Andrew Skilton is one, and the version by Vesna and Alan Wallace is the second. These two were translated from the Sanskrit. Now that text, that Sanskrit text is slightly different than the text of the Tibetan. There are many verses that have minor differences, and there are some verses that are in one but not in the other, and some verses that are just completely different in the two. But basically it's the same text. The same, more or less the same number of verses in the same order. The version that was passed down in the Tibetan was translated and then retranslated, edited twice, and the final version was translated by Shalu Lotsawa. And that's become the standard. Often when I work with texts that come from the Sanskrit tradition, I kind of give the Sanskrit a little bit more weight than the Tibetan, in a sense, because we know, well, this is the work of Dharmakirti's actual words, or this is Vasubandhu's actual words, and so we give it. So there's a tendency, I guess I'm still Western enough that I have a tendency to maybe give more credence to those than the Tibetan. Or when there are sticky questions, then I'll go back to those as like the source. But when coming to this one, the Sanskrit source is a good source, but it's a different type of text. This is a text that it's not just a philosophical inquiry, but it's a really direct practice of how do we become bodhisattvas? How do we take the bodhisattva vow? What is bodhicitta? How do we take the bodhisattva vow? And then how do we go through the path of a bodhisattva? So this is a living tradition that people have been practicing since the 8th century. So for that reason, because of that tradition that comes down, and that's the tradition that I've been taught in. So because of that, I generally, working on it now, I've been taking this Tibetan as a real living text. It's a real treasure. Whether or not it becomes less important to me, is this the actual words of Shantideva or not, but is this the path that we need to practice that will bring us benefit? And the experience of so many Tibetan masters shows that it is. So that's why my approach to the text in terms of the Tibetan versus the Sanskrit. I'm going into more academic detail than I thought I was going to. I'm sorry about that. But this is 10-chapter text, and it's important to know what the text is and where it comes from. Because it's a 10-chapter text, we aren't going to get through the whole thing tonight. We aren't going to get through the whole thing in a weekend. I hope to come back and do it, to continue teaching on it in future years. We should take a few years to get through it. I've been doing this in Hong Kong, actually. I started teaching it in Hong Kong in 2014. So I'll be teaching it. I'll be teaching the 6th and 7th chapters there next month. And starting teaching it in Hong Kong, I started teaching from the Padmakara translation, which is a really inspiring. When I first read it in 1998, they did a version in 1997, and then re-edited it quite heavily in 2007. So I started teaching it in Hong Kong from that the second Padmakara edition, which is in many ways an inspiring work, but for me it didn't have the same flavor as the Tibetan. There are a few points where I interpret it differently. Maybe that's just we translators are always like that, finding things that we agree with are different. But there's a certain, when you recite the Tibetan, they're short line lengths, they're consistent. There are places where the Tibetan meter changes. Those are exactly the same places as where the Sanskrit meter changes. You can actually download recordings of the Sanskrit if you want. It's online, bodhisvara.org, I think. You can get recordings of the Sanskrit online if you'd like to listen to it. It's really actually a very beautiful recording. But every place there's a change in the Sanskrit meter, there's a change in the Tibetan meter. Where there are long lines, like in the dedication chapter that we'll recite at the end of each of our sessions, unless I blab on too much about academic things, there are places where there are these long lines, you know, talking about the joy of beings in hell who are freed from their experience. Freed from the experience of hell. And then, you know, it cuts down into these short lines that go through just may all beings be free of all the various different types of suffering. And so there's this literary quality. So I have to admit that one of the main reasons for working on this translation is a literary one, because of the feeling that I have from reciting the Tibetan, listening to the Sanskrit. And hoping to get that a little bit in an English translation. So, and then the other was that many portions of the way the Bodhisattva are in the Kagyu Munlam book, and we wanted to do an electronic version of it, of the Kagyu Munlam book. And last time we tried to get permissions from Shambhala, was great about permissions until they hired someone else out, and it got to be too much of a pain because I think we were two small potatoes for him to worry about. And so let's not go through permissions. I wanted to retranslate it anyways. I'm going to start. So the most of the second and third chapter are also published in the latest edition of the Kagyu Munlam book. So I think that's the sort of background on the text and this particular translation.